Resilient Cyber Podcast brings you conversations from diverse cybersecurity professionals, ranging from executives, subject matter experts, and aspiring entrants. Today's diverse threat landscape requires systems that can withstand a variety of cyber incidents, remaining trustworthy and secure.
Resilient Cyber is sponsored by Acquia, a cybersecurity service, disabled veteran-owned small business that is passionate about enabling innovation and driving secure digital transformation. Acquia believes in guardrails over roadblocks and security as a business and mission enabler. Learn more at acquia.us. That's A-Q-U-I-A.us. Before we start the episode, we want to give a big thank you to our season 4 sponsor, Nucleus Security. Meet Nucleus, the only risk-based vulnerability management platform purpose-built for the world's most complex enterprises. Nucleus takes the mountain of vulnerability data that is produced by your security stack and unifies it into one clean dashboard that helps you make sense of your assets and vulnerabilities. With Nucleus, users get a normalized and deduplicated list of vulnerabilities across network devices, cloud, applications, and more. Next, we layer in risk and vulnerability intelligence from sources like Mandiant to help you prioritize the vulnerabilities that matter most. Ready to see how Nucleus can help improve your vulnerability management program? Head to nucleussec.com today.
Thank you for joining Resilient Cyber. My name is Chris Hughes, and today I'm joined by Michael McLaughlin and Bill Holstein. Gents, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us, Chris.
And I hope I didn't butcher that last name like I said I would, Mike. But before we dive into talking about, you know, your guys' book and all the topics therein, can you guys tell us a bit about your background and, you know, what you're up to these days?
Age before beauty. Bill, you want to go first?
Well, I started understanding the Chinese psychology, Chinese language when I was based in Hong Kong and later in Beijing as Bureau Chief for United Press International. So I was there at the very beginning of the U.S.-Chinese relationship, and I followed all these years. And then along the way, I started developing a passion for the technology side of it and started covering things like the Microsoft antitrust trial. And so I've seen the broad sweep of history. And so what's so unique about our collaboration is that we're from such dramatically different backgrounds, ages, one's beautiful, one's older. And so and Mike will tell you about his background. But what's so remarkable is that the combination of our skills and analysis help create a coherent portrait of what the Chinese and Russians have done. And we spotlight, we analyze our vulnerabilities and why we're so vulnerable. And then we talk about solutions. So I'm pleased to think that this is a golden partnership. Mike?
Yeah, no. And as Bill said, he comes from the journalist background. I come from the military background. I'm a practicing attorney in DC, where I focus on cybersecurity and incident response law and helping clients that are navigating these huge threats that are coming from threat actors coming from nation states. And so my background, Naval Academy grad and did 12 and a half years as a Naval Intelligence Officer, where I focused on counterintelligence and human intelligence. The last 5 years, I was a U.S. Cyber Command, where I was the Senior Counterintelligence Advisor for U.S. Cyber Command. And I was the Chief of Counterintelligence and Human Intelligence for the Cyber National Mission Force as we were ramping up and doing our hunt forward operations overseas, primarily in the lead up to the conflict with Ukraine.
Yeah, you guys come, you know, as Bill pointed out, you guys come from definitely different backgrounds, but I think it's a great pair in terms of tackling it from the cultural aspect, but also the technological and legal aspect. And it really brings a unique richness and perspective to the topic. And for folks that aren't familiar, you guys are both the authors of a new book that's titled Battlefield Cyber, How China and Russia Are Undermining Our Democracy and National Security. So before we dive into that, you know, for folks that are unfamiliar with this problem, I know a lot of us have been paying quite a bit of attention to this problem, but, you know, what is the situation here and why exactly should we be paying such attention to it?
Yeah. So the reason why we set out on this book is we looked across the whole spectrum. We looked across the threats. We looked across what was happening in the country. What Bill and I both came to realize is that there is a dramatic lack of understanding as to what is the full scope of this conflict. It's not like any other conflict. It's not like anything we've ever seen. It's not ship on ship. It's not tank on tank. Everything is a battlefield. And what we continue to say say and to tell people, and our drumbeat is, if you connect to the internet, you're on this battlefield. There really are no non-combatants. And we need to start thinking like that, because our traditional notion within the United States is we have military operations, and that's for the military to conduct and to deal with. We have law enforcement operations, and that's for the police and the FBI to deal with. Everything else is all commercial, and we typically want the government to go hands off. Well, that's not the way we have to take this situation. And the reason behind that is because we have individuals from foreign countries who are basically being used as proxies, or we have nation states that are going to utilize any aspect that they can to target us. And so we need to look at how do our nation state adversaries define cyber warfare, or define conflict, or define warfare, as opposed to what we traditionally define it as. And we traditionally define warfare under the international convention, whereas it's if you breach the physical border of a country, that constitutes warfare. If you conduct a kinetic strike against critical infrastructure, that's obviously warfare. Well, espionage doesn't rise to that level. And so when we see things like SolarWinds, for instance, SolarWinds was a huge backdoor. It was a software supply chain vulnerability that was conducted by a foreign, an adversarial intelligence service. Well, that constitutes espionage until it doesn't, right? Because it's espionage up until the point that they use that backdoor to turn out the lights, or they use that backdoor to poison the water, or they use that backdoor to pick a number of any sort of cyber operations that then in turn rise to the level of armed conflict. And so cyberspace is this spectrum that we don't really currently have a structure within the United States to understand. And we need to start to change that narrative. And we need to start to have a good understanding that our adversaries look at everything within cyberspace as a conflict zone, as an area that is a battlefield. We need to take that same approach, and we need to protect ourselves.
From my point of view, my deepest concern is that Chinese and Russians have penetrated tens of thousands of our computing systems in this country. We have not defended those systems. We have allowed them to enter, and the Chinese like to remain in the background, like to listen and learn and steal. The Russians are more inclined to do malware and do things that earn them money. But the combination of this is that we don't have control of our IT systems in this country, and that we're incredibly vulnerable in our critical infrastructure. I mean, the federal feds did catch the Russians trying to plant malware at a nuclear power plant in Kansas. Imagine, and I think we have to assume that our critical infrastructure has been bugged with malware or backdoors or remote Trojans or whatever they are, but so that we have urgent matters of national viability, and we are not organized to respond to it. We have the private sector that has their set of responsibilities and set of goals, and we have the public sector, government, which has a deeper sense of concern about this, particularly in the military and intelligence community. So, and adding up these pieces, we Mike and I believe we face a national crisis. We face an urgent matter of national survival.
Yeah, I think you both are spot on. And, you know, I'll say from my perspective, you know, we're all in this kind of technology space or paying close attention to it. But I have run into folks that say, well, it's not kinetic conflict. You know, no one's necessarily dying. They don't think it's necessarily a big deal, which I try to stress that, you know, the ubiquity of software in our society now today touches everything from, you know, our leisurely activities, our personal phones, to, you know, everything to our critical infrastructure, national security, intelligence community, and so on. You know, how do you kind of hammer home that point to folks that, you know, that the importance of this, you know, persistent threat being in our critical infrastructure, kind of just lying in wait for the day that maybe a kinetic conflict comes, for example? You know, I'm curious from you guys how you kind of get that point home to folks.
Yeah, and I think you have to think of it in the sense that imagine or think of all of the things that we rely on when it comes to critical infrastructure. And really, electric underpins everything. And you can say that, you know, we have 17 critical infrastructure sectors now. Really, electric underpins all of them, because without electricity, you don't really have water. Without electricity, you don't have healthcare. Without electricity, you don't have a defense industrial base. And so I would say, you know, you have critical infrastructure, but not all are created equal. And so let's take just electricity and the electric grid as an example. When people think about all of the things that we require when it comes to electricity and everything that we rely upon, whether it's communications for your Wi-Fi, whether it's your ability to go to a hospital and have healthcare be delivered to you, whether it's to charge your iPhone, whether it's to make sure that your pacemaker is effectively communicating with the system that it's communicating with. All of these things are underpinned by electricity. Well, our grid is this patchwork of different providers, and all of the providers are at different levels of cybersecurity maturity. Well, what happens if you have a provider that's, say, providing electricity to Manhattan, and that goes down? Well, these giant transformers, they're made to order. It's not like we have a backlog of transformers. And so if there is physical damage done to that, Manhattan goes dark. Think about the thousands of people who would be trapped in elevators if there is no power in Manhattan. Aside from all of the other issues, aside from the financial sector completely collapsing, aside from the run on hospitals, aside from looting, aside from all of the other issues that go along with it, just the loss of life alone, you're talking loss of life that would be higher than 9/11 from people who are trapped in elevators. And that's it. That's what you kind of have to think about. Cybersecurity and what we are facing, it is much more pernicious, and there the possibility of significantly negative ramifications is so much higher than anything we've ever faced. And that's just one aspect of it. That's not getting into if you compromise the blueprints of the next generation stealth fighter, and then we go into a conflict with the Chinese and suddenly that the weapons on that fighter are not working. Well, yeah, then we're going to lose that conflict. But even the most basic thing, let's come back home and just say, what happens if the power goes out? And if we say that's worst case scenario, how do we protect against that? And right now, we don't really have a very strong way of doing that. And when I say a strong way of doing that, we have a patchwork of providers. We have CISA, we have Department of Energy. Everybody's looking at this problem, but we're looking at it as we're going to put forth requirements and regulations. And well, what about subsidies? What about having, you know, cyber protection teams that are assigned specifically for incidents that occur in the electric grid? Because I'm going to tell you right now, if it happens and we have a large scale attack on the entire electric grid or in multiple sections of the electric grid, it's not something that we're able to handle.
May I just say two things that in researching this book that sort of jumped out at me. One is that we have these known vulnerabilities that NIST within the Department of Commerce identifies and publicizes. They go public with it. Their goal, of course, is to encourage companies to issue patches and then encourage client companies to apply those patches. But the system has been abused in the sense that NIST comes out with their list of known vulnerabilities, and there are thousands of them, thousands of known vulnerabilities, which are avenues into our systems. And they go public with it, and China's Ministry of State Security, their version of the CIA, monitors what the U.S. government is announcing to the world are the known vulnerabilities in our computing systems. And according to a report by CISA and FBI, the Ministry of State Security then goes visits those companies before the patches can be applied, if those companies even choose to apply the patches, and they can put their malware in the recycling bins or in one of the servers that the system administrators don't normally pay much attention to. That's one thing that's just absolutely insane about our system. The second thing is, I'm a student about this, is how our software is written. That a program may have just a thousand lines of code that are proprietary and unique, but a software developer will use open source software from repositories like GitHub and others. And those open repositories can be compromised, and they are compromised. So when I'm developing my program, do I double check all those programs I'm borrowing, I'm utilizing for any known vulnerabilities? No. So that when I issue my program and my application, I know that what I wrote was probably good, secure, but I have no idea what's in the rest of the software. So we're playing with a Russian roulette, but you know, one bullet in the chamber that we don't know what the quality of our software is.
Yeah, so I'm going to be honest with you guys. You both opened up a bit of a can of worms that I'm going to dive down a rabbit hole with each of you on an additional question that you talked about. So from your perspective, Michael, you talked about kind of the challenges of our critical infrastructure and how the overwhelming majority of it's owned by private entities, for example. And we're structured differently, nationally and economically than some of the nations that we're talking about here, who have kind of carte blanche across all their infrastructure, all their systems, all their, you know, organizations and private companies, for example. You know, how do we balance, you know, regulating those entities to move away from, you know, kind of voluntary compliance, but not lose the, you know, kind of the freedom and aspects of our society that allow people to innovate and kind of, you know, go out there and do things like that in the commercial sector?
Yeah, and there are a couple of ways to do that, and primarily in what you said, innovation, right? And why our system in general, our system, I believe, is superior to that of any autocratic nation is because we have the ability to innovate, and we are incentivizing our companies, our individuals, our populace to continuously innovate because of capitalism, right? You are rewarded for innovation. You're able to bring your technology, whatever, to market. You're able to sell it in an open system, and thus we have innovation, and we develop things faster and better and of higher quality. And that's, like, we'll talk about this later, I'm sure, but why the Chinese are constantly stealing our data. It's because we innovate. And so you don't want to stifle that by throwing regulation upon regulation, because then you're going to price people out of the market. And in some cases with critical infrastructure, there are certain areas of the country, and I continue to use electricity as an example, but we could say Wi-Fi. There are spots in the country that don't have cell coverage, you cannot get access to the internet. And this is one of the Biden administration's big pushes, is that they want to give everybody access to Wi-Fi, everybody equal access to the internet. Well, sometimes you're just not incentivized to provide that type of access to rural areas that there's only one family within 1,000 miles. So how do you balance those types of things where you're looking for innovation, you're looking to ensure that you're providing the right incentives? So my recommendation for that is we have a couple of options that is at the disposal of the federal government. The primary one is taxes. You can always provide tax incentives to companies for cybersecurity or for having backups. And in the case of the electric grid, you're not going to tell an electric or electricity provider that they need to have backup transformers. So those transformers are, in some cases, hundreds of millions of dollars. They're built over the period of, you know, 6 months to a year on back order. You can't get them. And so to have one just sitting in the case of a cyber attack is ludicrous, and it's just not going to happen. At least it's not going to happen if you're regulating and telling a company to do that.
May I just jump in to say that we interviewed Mark Montgomery, an admiral who's head of the Solarium Commission, right? Solarium, is that it, Mike? Solarium? Yep. So he said when they go to say to a private sector utility, why don't you build in some more redundancy in this system. And the companies look at it as, well, that's going to cost money. That's going to affect our profitability. That's going to affect our share price. That's going to affect their personal compensation. No, we don't see any need to do that. Well, so, and if the government says to them, well, we're really, really worried about you and we think you're vulnerable, what the private sector and invariably says back is, well, if you're worried about us and national security, then you pay for the redundancy, you pay for the extra expense. Don't expect us to take a hit to our profitability. So that's the heart of the conundrum, is that our private sector and public sector have defined their roles and as part of our wide open democratic system, and we find it very difficult to mount a cohesive response to what our authoritarian single-party rivals and adversaries are doing on our own soil. Sorry, I interrupted.
No,
I
Bill.
I carried away with myself.
Bill, you're spot on. And I mean, and so the question becomes is how do you incentivize that resilience? And so certainly taxes are one way of doing tax incentives or subsidies to these companies for the specific purpose of resilience. And the other one is the Defense Production Act. The Defense Production Act allows the president in times of crisis to increase production within the United States for national security purposes. And so the Defense Production Act is a critical tool that's at the disposal of the president exclusively to be able to mitigate some of these risks. And so if we want to build in redundancy in critical infrastructure, sometimes it's incentives to companies, sometimes it's regulation, sometimes it's providing, you know, using the Defense Production Act the way it's supposed to be used, or it's a combination of them. But we can't just expect that, you know, cybersecurity, we're not going to have the cybersecurity framework put out by NIST be the end all and be all for protecting our critical infrastructure against threat actors. It's just not realistic. And we're also not going to be able to regulate and tell companies to spend an inordinate amount of money to protect themselves when the government's not willing to put the same amount of money behind it. So it needs to be a public-private partnership.
Mike, tell them about how it works when a private sector company has a problem. Maybe they have an attack. I mean, they don't know who to go to. Do we go to CISA or FBI, or who do we turn to? That there's not a unified governmental mechanism for managing systematic risk and communicating threat information to the private sector. Did I get that right?
Yeah, you did. I mean, and this gets to the sectoral approach of our system. And so it's, you know, if you are a private sector company and you're not in critical infrastructure, well, you have to look at your industry and you have to determine what is the threat to the data itself, or what's the threat to the industry, what's the threat to what it is that I'm doing. So if you're in healthcare, you're obviously covered by HIPAA. If you're a publicly traded company, you've got SEC regulations. If you are in finance, you've got NYDFS. There are a whole patchwork of requirements. Well, if you're just a small business, typically you're just looking at what is my state requirement? What does the state attorney general say that I have to do in the case of a breach? And then you follow that. But from a federal government reporting standpoint, the FBI has the Internet, I always mess this up, the Internet Crime Complaint Center, IC3, that you can submit an Internet crime complaint. But that's everything from fraud to ransomware, and you submit a form into the black box and you never hear anything back from the FBI. And if you try to get a hold of the FBI, the different field offices are, you know, and I love the FBI. So this is no shade on my FBI brethren, but the different field offices work very independently unto themselves, and they have different leadership, but they have different focus. And so if you're hit with ransomware, you can call your local FBI field office, but the chances of your local FBI field office actually working that case is almost zero. And so we have kind of a problem when it comes to reporting, communicating, and certainly information flow as it relates to the federal government pushing information down to the private sector. But it's also the private sector giving information to the federal government so that the government can do something about it, so that Cybercom can go respond, so that the FBI can go respond, or the NSA can do something. That gap and that lack of communication creates a huge problem both for the private sector and for the government. And it doesn't seem that we're really making a lot of headway to resolve that issue.
Yeah. You guys said so many things that are worth emphasizing there. I think that, you know, that sectoral approach, the bifurcated aspect of our agencies and institutions and their field offices. And then, you know, many of us are obviously old enough to remember another incident that happened that did include a loss of life. And it came down to lack of communications in some cases between agencies and entities. For example, speaking to 9/11. So I wanted to ask a question of Bill and maybe both of you, because you both gave a response on the previous one. Bill talked about the NIST National Vulnerability Database, you know, that produces CVEs, you know, vulnerabilities in software. This is kind of my area of expertise. I've written a book on software supply chain security, talked about open source software, proprietary software, and so on. There's a big push right now for software transparency to better equip software consumers to understand the vulnerabilities, you know, in their software from software suppliers. You know, and obviously, like, malicious actors are going to go out there and look at that same database, like Bill talked about, and try to take advantage of those vulnerabilities. I'm curious your guys' thoughts, and obviously you don't have to have a perfect answer. I know it's a tough problem. How do we equip consumers, enterprise organizations, downstream citizens, whomever, to understand vulnerabilities in their software, but also keep it hidden from malicious actors, maybe from nation states or even inside our country?
This is a $64 million question. It seems to me that we need to say to software developers, you need to take greater care in how you build your software. The companies that are buying the software need to specify, we insist that you deliver software that is free of any known vulnerabilities. That alone would change the equation. Companies, what people in the government don't understand is the mentality and the psychology of what goes on in the corporate boardroom. Companies say, we don't really care if our systems are 100% secure. What we want to do is make money. That's our primary goal. So that if the Chinese are in our systems, as long as we have a CISO, as long as we have a cyber security consulting company and an insurance policy, then whenever there's a breach or a damage, we can shift the burden of this onto the insurance industry, and we continue to make good money. So the mentality that exists in the private sector, both among the people who develop the software and the people who buy the software, is not one of a keen focus on the security of the software. So it's a whole, as you know, it's a whole industry. How do you change a whole industry? Probably not through regulation. It probably has to be something that maybe there's an institute is created, a software security institute of some sort is created, or the software industry needs to come together and figure out, how do we do this? The government can change some of the incentives. For example, the SEC now is requiring that cyber incidents that are material be reported to the U.S. government within 4 days. So there, the things that the U.S. government can do are can shape the legal and environment that software companies and all companies operate in, but the government alone can't solve this problem.
Yeah. And I'll if you don't mind, I'll chime in on just one aspect of that. I think this is one of the rare instances where Bill and I somewhat disagree. So when it comes to the software, I think the reason why we have why we continue to have vulnerabilities is because that's just the nature of the software industry. It's you're constantly in beta testing. And that's why you've Microsoft is going to pay $100,000 to white hat hackers to identify vulnerabilities through their bug bounty program. I mean, that's a normal thing. And that's just how we understand how software works, because it's never going to be perfect. And if it is perfect, then you're spending way too much time developing. And at that point, it's no longer even usable by consumers. And we see this in other industries as well. I mean, when General Motors puts out a vehicle, the vehicle is not perfect. That's why there are recalls. And there are constantly recalls. General Motors puts out a vehicle knowing that a certain percentage of the motors that are the engines that get on the road are going to explode. It's just going to happen. You're going to have something that goes wrong that's going to cause loss of life. But ultimately, General Motors is going to put 1 million cars on the road. And if there are 5 of those cars that explode causing loss of life, that is an acceptable risk to General Motors, because then you have 995 or 999, whatever, thousand vehicles that are on the road, they're operating and functioning appropriately and functioning the way they should. And so there is a give and take that you kind of have to just accept and understand in any industry, that there is going to be some risk, and that we don't want to turn a blind eye to it and just accept it, but we need to know how to mitigate it. And so while software vulnerabilities are going to exist, I think there are some things that we can focus on that are beyond just software vulnerabilities. And I think it's more of, well, how are threat actors actually accessing networks to exploit these vulnerabilities? If you accept the fact that any software inherently is vulnerable, and I think that's the first thing we just need to accept, like software is vulnerable, period. Whether it's vulnerable today or whether 0 day is discovered tomorrow, it's going to be vulnerable. And then we're going to have a patch and we're going to be in this constant game of catch up or whack-a-mole or whatever idiom you want to use. But how are the threat actors actually getting into the network to exploit the vulnerabilities in the first place? By and large, it's credentials. Right. And so you've got somebody who's going in, they're clicking on a phishing link, or they're typing in their username and password in a fraudulent web page, or they're somehow giving access to a threat actor to the network so that they can exploit a vulnerability. If we resolve the problem of credentials, if we say, you know, multi-factor authentication across the board, well, that's a great step up. But what's beyond multi-factor authentication? How do we remove the user from that? How do we remove typing in passwords? How do we remove usernames? And how do we make that more secure? Because if we can get to the point that we're making credentials fully secure, then the software vulnerabilities almost don't matter, because nobody's getting into the network in the first place.
Yeah, there's an often kind of a thing that's, you know, parroted in our industry is like attackers don't hack in, they log in. And if you look at things like the Verizon DBIR, for example, it shows you credential compromise is top of the list for how they get into systems. I actually tend to lean into the camp of your opinion in terms of there'll never be vulnerability-free software. But I am a big proponent of what we're seeing the industry do, in particularly like CISA and others who are pushing for organizations, software suppliers to use things like NIST Secure Software Development Framework, yeah, and test that they're following these practices. And then it comes down to, you know, helping consumers understand, you know, what is the posture, the hygiene, the vulnerability, you know, kind of residue that remains in the product when I get it that I have to accept and make some risk acceptance of. But at least I'm informed around that and able to make informed decisions. So I want to ask you guys, before we went on air, we talked a little bit about another topic, which is, you know, malicious actors, even nation state actors, for example, using U.S.-based infrastructure to conduct attacks on, you know, U.S. victims, whether commercial or federal victims or, you know, state, local governments, educational institutions, et cetera. And this is touched on a national cybersecurity strategy. And it's particularly, you know, complicated in the world of cloud, where people can dynamically spin up and down infrastructure, conduct attacks, you know, tear the infrastructure down and just go on their way, hide behind VPNs or other kind of things to obfuscate, you know, who they are, where they're coming from. You know, how do we kind of get to this problem? I know you guys talk about this in the book as well.
Yeah, and go ahead, Bill.
I want to hear what you have to say, Mike.
Well, so I think this, again, this is a difficult challenge because we utilize cloud. We're every, even in the National Cyber Strategy and EO 14028, we have consistently, as a federal government, have pushed the private sector to go more to cloud-based infrastructure because for a lot of reasons. Is it more secure? In some cases, yes. In some cases, it still has different vulnerabilities, but still has vulnerabilities. And so we're very much pushing for this move to the cloud. We want people to be utilizing VPNs when they're operating from a home network. We want that because it's more secure. But on the flip side of that, those types of companies, they make money on having very, you know, brief infrastructure or having dynamic nodes that they're using. And Chris, this is kind of what you were getting to, as opposed to the hard nodes that's coming out of your house, like your Wi-Fi router or your device, having a dynamic node where you can spin up an IP address that's coming out of, you know, wherever, coming out of Virginia Beach or coming out of Belarus, being able to do that has benefit, and it has benefit for a lot of reasons. One's latency. One is if you're trying to mask your location, if you're living in an authoritarian society. And so there are some like First Amendment type issues. There are some national security and diplomatic reasons why we don't necessarily want to completely inhibit that activity. But at the same time, if we have threat actors who are coming to VPN vendors or VPS vendors within the United States, and they're purchasing or they're leasing IP ranges for a period of 24 hours, and then those IP ranges get spun up, they use them for their nefarious activity, then all of that activity log gets deleted, and those IP addresses are then spun and sold to somebody else. Well, that VPN provider is now complicit in whatever that threat actor did. Whether they say it's like, no, we don't have any requirements, well, you should. And a know your customer requirement for VPN, VPS providers would go a long way to resolve some of this issue. SolarWinds, again, another great example of how SolarWinds, like the sophistication of how it was done, but also highlighting some of the vulnerabilities. The SVR actors who compromised SolarWinds, they did it from a US-based VPN. And so the fact that they were able to get into a US-based VPN, it appeared to be legitimate traffic coming from within the United States. What does that mean? Well, that means the NSA can't monitor it. The NSA can't monitor it because it's within the United States, and the NSA's jurisdiction is only outside of the United States IP range. And so they can't directly monitor that activity once it crosses the border of the US. Well, our adversaries know that, and they know that's a limitation we have, so they're going to actively exploit it. What does the FBI have to do? Well, if it's a US-based VPN, the FBI would then have to go and issue a warrant or a subpoena that's issued by a magistrate or a court in order to get access to the information, whether it's the financial information or the logs. And so there's this latency that inherently occurs because you're not doing that in real time. And so we don't have a way to monitor. We don't have a way to force those VPS, VPN providers to turn over or divulge that information. Quite frankly, if they delete it, and there's no record, and you've got a threat actor who was using, you know, a false or a fraudulent financial account to purchase that in the first place, it's gone. We just don't have the records in order to do that. And so part of the problem or part of the solution to this issue would be enforcing a know your customer requirement as it relates to VPS, VPNs.
So these cloud computing systems are inherently global and enormously complex. And I don't think that they're living up to their marketing hype, the vendor spin, that they're a panacea for security. So we found that they can be penetrated. The Chinese APTs have proven consistently that they can attack a cloud computing system from multiple computers all around the world, not just computers based in China. And they can penetrate the cloud computing system and live inside it. In one case, APT-10, I believe it was, in 2018, penetrated IBM's cloud computing system And the government discovered it. And the Wall Street Journal asked IBM, was it true that you had Chinese were in your system for years? IBM said, we can find no evidence that they were in our system because of the genius of how the data was encrypted and exfiltrated. IBM just couldn't see it, didn't see it. And most recently, we were seeing difficulties with Microsoft's cloud email services, which the U.S. Department of State, Department of Commerce, the U.S. ambassador to China were using. And the Chinese got access to many of them, maybe not for the secretaries, but for the people around them. At the time when Secretary of State Blinken was going to China, think of that our adversaries, our number one adversary in the world, can dig into our computing systems and understand what our government is going to do. And at the same time, they're digging into the military's use of Microsoft's cloud computing system, trying to interrupt their communications in Guam. And in fact, most recently, the New York Times disclosed that U.S. officials believe that the Chinese inserted malware into our infrastructure, critical infrastructure, but they can't find it. So there are just huge, enormous exposures, vulnerabilities that our private sector companies, in this case, I'm obviously talking about Microsoft, I think they have some explaining to do about how secure are their systems. We saw the exchange, Microsoft Exchange, in the 2021 timeframe. That was a big deal because millions of emails go through these Microsoft Exchange servers and systems. So I'd like to ask Microsoft, I mean, I think our big tech companies have to come clean on how secure are their systems.
And just to riff off of that real quick, Chris, because I know we keep cutting you off on your questions, but just to riff off of that really quick, one of the biggest problems with that, with exactly what Bill's talking about at Microsoft, is the DoD is now penning full-scale agreements with Microsoft to give them full control over the stack. And so everything from the on-prem devices to the operating system to the cloud-based infrastructure, then down to the cybersecurity aspect of it. Well, if you're doing that, you have Microsoft, who has more CVEs published than anyone in the world. Granted, they are the single largest provider of software in the world, and so it makes sense. But it's kind of the fox guarding the hen house if you've got your cybersecurity provider being the same one who's developing the software that's also developing your cloud, that's also dealing with your operating system. And so for the DoD to put all of this, all of its eggs in one basket as it relates to Microsoft and its software and its cybersecurity capabilities, I think is a fool's errand. And I think it's, number one, stifling innovation and kind of what we were talking about before. If you're not incentivized to innovate, then that dies. And so if we're saying that Microsoft, we're going to select Microsoft as our winner, being the DoD, we're going to select Microsoft as our winner, what does that do to the other companies who could potentially be better providers of cybersecurity for the DoD or be better providers of cloud-based platforms for the DoD? Well, they're not going to try, they're not going to innovate, or they're going to focus their efforts elsewhere, where otherwise they may be able to provide a better solution that's more secure for our national security.
Yeah, you guys dropped a lot of gems in there. I wanted to jump in and kind of emphasize a few things. I dropped a lot of links in the chat here. For example, I dropped some links around the Chinese hack of critical infrastructure throughout Guam. There's now a House panel looking into this email hack with Microsoft. And also Atlantic Council has some great publications around critical infrastructure and cloud and resiliency. And also, you raise an interesting point, and I've kind of been writing about this lately, is Microsoft, you know, they're routinely at the top of the CISA, known exploited vulnerability list, but they're also globally pervasive as one of the largest software suppliers in the world. And it is an interesting paradigm where they're so pervasive and ubiquitous across DoD and federal government, for example, in terms of cloud. They're on the, you know, $10 billion JWCC cloud contract, for example. They have almost $20 billion, I think, in cybersecurity revenue, but they're also one of the most routinely breached and exploited software suppliers. So it's this very interesting conundrum. And I expect that, you know, organizations of that size likely have some very strong lobbying arms and some strong legal teams as well, which Michael knows about legal side of things. And I want to, you know, pivot a little bit. We talked about, you know, the need for diversity among our supply chain. We're seeing a push within the defense industrial base. You know, we have this initially NIST 800-171, which was a voluntary compliance framework. We see how well those have worked so far historically. They allow for self-attestations, and we had, you know, defense suppliers self-attesting that, yeah, we're doing all the security controls and practices laid out in 800-171. Meanwhile, we had, you know, multi-billion dollar research and development plans being pilfered by nation states like China and others. Now we've seen an advance towards the Cybersecurity Maturity Model Certification, CMMC, which introduces kind of a third party attestation model. And I wanted to kind of level set here. I've worked on the FedRAMP team in the past myself as a government employee that kind of vets cloud for government use. FedRAMP has been around for 10 years. It uses a 3PAO model, and in 10 years, it has about 300 approved service providers in that marketplace among tens of thousands. So obviously, you have this dichotomy between self-attestation and a broad market, diverse market of suppliers, and then third-party attestation and kind of funneling down that market due to the rigor and the, you know, kind of the cost and burden of going through the process. You know, any thoughts on how do we, you know, kind of maintain a robust, diverse supplier base in the defense industrial base, for example? We've seen a lot of consolidation, you know, among big suppliers in DoD. You talk about the need to introduce, you know, other suppliers, other alternatives, have this diverse, you know, supplier ecosystem, but also we have this need for security and rigor and governance, which, you know, only often the most well-equipped, well-resourced suppliers can kind of meet. So how do we do that delicate dance?
Yeah, in CMMC, I mean, and likewise, you touched on a lot of different things there. And so I'm gonna focus on CMMC because the FedRAMP process, obviously, FedRAMP is expensive. It's a long process. And it's something that once you get through, then you're kind of behind that walled garden and you're able to sell cloud services to the government. And we're almost building that same thing for the defense industrial base. In a lot of cases, becoming CMMC compliant, while yes, the DFARS 7012 clause has been in play since 2017. And anybody doing business with the federal government, whether they are a contractor or subcontractor, has had to be in compliance with the NIST 800-171. We're now up to Rev 3 is going through the notice and comment period right now. And so it's already been in place, and kind of the stick, as opposed to the carrot here, the stick on all of this is that if a company is not in compliance, they're found to not be in compliance, where there's a breach and it shows that they were lying on their contract or they're not up to the NIST 110 controls, well, then you have potentially a False Claims Act case that can be brought against them. And in 2020, the Deputy Attorney General Lisa Monaco, or 2021, I think, Deputy Attorney General Lisa Monaco launched the Civil Cyber Fraud Task Force, which is specifically going after companies that do business with the federal government and targets them for False Claims Act cases. And they're looking for whistleblowers, but they're actively going after these companies. And that's kind of the stick aspect of it. That's always going to be the sword of Damocles hanging over the heads of the DIB contractors, and that if they are not up to speed and they're found to not be up to speed, there could be significant penalties. The most recent one was Aerojet Rocketdyne settled with the Department of Justice for $9 million last year as a result of a whistleblower QUITAM case that was a result of a False Claims Act that had to do with its compliance with the 7012 clause of the DFARS. So I'm throwing a lot of legalese at you, and I apologize. But all of that's to say, so now we have something in place. It's clearly not working, or it's not working as efficiently as we need it to. And so we're looking at FedRAMP as, well, maybe this is a better model. And we're kind of applying that FedRAMP model to the CMMC. And so the Cybersecurity Maturity Model Certification is now requiring the companies to, if they're level one, I believe it's self-attestation, level two or above, it's third-party attestation, where you need to go through a C3 PAO and have them attest to the fact that you are in compliance with the NIST 171. The problem is we don't have a whole lot of C3 PAOs. They haven't been brought online as quickly as possible. And so there's inherently going to be a backlog of companies that are not qualified. And there's going to have to be some sort of grace period for companies to become qualified or to get that third-party attestation. And there's going to be a backlog. Well, what happens if you're at the forefront of that and you're a large prime? Well, then you're fine, because you're probably going to get that C3PAO attestation and you're going to move forward. There's going to be a period where in that backlog, there are companies that just cannot get certified because either they're not big enough or they didn't get on the process early enough. And so they're going to be disqualified from doing business with the federal government. As a result, it's not to say that they don't have those 110 controls in place. They just don't have that certification. And so I think that's going to be a problem. The other thing that's going to be a problem is it is expensive, and getting in compliance with a baseline level of cybersecurity hygiene as it relates to the NIST 171, it can be expensive. And then going through that attestation process, you have to hire those firms. It is expensive. And so I've heard everything between $80,000 to $100,000 per company that wants to do this. I don't know if that number is accurate, but that's pretty significant if you're a small business and you're dealing with this. And then, oh, by the way, those 110 controls are just baseline. Those 110 controls don't necessarily meet the requirements of a nation state threat actor targeting your network. And so let's say you're above and beyond those 110 controls with something you're doing, as in, let's say you have an air gap network. And so you're handling CUI, you're handling classified information on an air gap network. That air gap network still has to comply with the 171 controls, which doesn't make any sense because that air gap network isn't actually connecting to the internet. That has a much stronger security, but we're still saying your network has to meet those 110 controls. And so there is a lot of ambiguity and there are certain things that don't make a whole lot of sense with CMMC. And we're trying to apply a very broad brush program to kind of a nuanced ecosystem. And so I would love to say, hey, I've got the best solution in the world and here's your silver bullet and CMMC should be out and this is what we should do. It's a hard problem. We've got 300,000 companies across the DIB and we need to make sure that we are effectively securing them. And so what we have going forward is, well, we've got CMMC, warts and all.
I'd just like to emphasize, I can't understand half of what Mike just said, but but I'd like to emphasize the severity of the Chinese penetration of the U.S. Navy, that as a result of the Office of Personnel Control, Office of Personnel Management theft in 2014, 2015, they got all the personally identifiable information members of the Navy, including Mike, who had top secret clearance at the time. Then in 2018, they got another 100,000 Navy PIIs, as well as maintenance schedules for ships and an amazing amount of data that they have about members of the U.S. Navy. Mike concludes, I learned this from Mike, I didn't make this up, that the Chinese probably have the personally identifiable information from all the senior leadership. Anybody who's joined the Navy after 2018 might be free and clear, but anybody who's been in the U.S. Navy for a serious amount of time is probably known. And the Chinese can use this data to, they have travel data, they have health data, they have all sorts of data that they can collate in effect. And if they're a person of interest in the U.S. government, whether it's an intel or a military, they can track the travel of these people. And if they go to China, basically they can't really meet any Chinese individuals because they will be arrested on the spot. So the Chinese penetration of the Pentagon systems, not to mention the broader American and corporate systems, is profound. And it's a matter of who can win in this engagement. If the Chinese know all this, have all this data, can track the movement of ships, know when they're going in for maintenance and all that, then we've lost the war before it started. The Chinese are masters of this kind of conflict. In the art of war, the new art of war. I wrote a book called The New Art of War based on the art of war. And in that book, the famous philosopher wrote, the supreme art of war is to win without fighting. And that's exactly what the Chinese are doing. They're trying to win without actually having kinetic war.
Yeah, you kind of took me right into my next question for you both, which is, you know, you talked about this, you know, these activities are essentially occurring below, and you talk about this in the book, you know, occurring below what we consider the declaration of an act of war. But when you look at our society and how pervasive software is and how critical it is to everything we do now, including national security, U.S. economic prosperity, and so on, is it time to maybe update our definition of what we consider an act of war? And you know, how do we get our leadership in Congress and so on to understand the severity of this threat?
It's Mike's department.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, when you talk about acts of war, it's not just something we do unilaterally within the United States. I mean, that this is within the UN Convention. We start talking about what constitutes warfare, what constitutes a right to self-defense or a right to engage in armed conflict. Those are very clearly articulated in the UN Charter. But then it's, well, what constitutes an act of aggression that would rise to the level or necessitate or authorize self-defense? And so this is an international law question that a lot of people have been wrestling with. And you've got the Talon Manual versions 1 and 2 that look at this problem. And you've got most recently with the Ukraine war, you had the Secretary General of or the NATO Secretary say that we believe that a cyber attack constitutes an act of war if it rises to the level of a kinetic strike. And then that would trigger Article 5 of NATO, which would authorize NATO countries to then respond, or then to collectively respond to Russian acts of aggression. But the problem is, it's like, well, then what is that act of aggression? And how do we identify what that area is in that gray zone? And the Russians are really good at this. The Chinese really do focus on stealing IP, on creating backdoors, on lying in wait, and ensuring that they have all of their chess pieces in play before they go to war. And I truly believe that's what the Chinese are doing. They're stealing intellectual property, certainly. But they are putting things in place, and they are setting their board so that in the event of conflict, they are fully ready. And this goes back to what Bill said about Sun Tzu and the way the Chinese view warfare. The Russians are different and patently. And I think you have to understand how the two conduct themselves and how the two conduct operations in cyberspace. The Russians are much louder. The Russians are much more willing to go right up against that line and in some cases cross that line. And we saw that in both the physical space, obviously Ukraine being the primary example, and then also in cyberspace in Notpetya, right? So the Russians went up and conducted and what it equates to an armed attack against the Ukrainian MEDocs, which was an accounting software, but to take down Ukrainian infrastructure. And then that bled out and caused $10 billion worth of damage globally. Well, was that an act of war? We didn't call it an act of war, but it was a nation state engaged in armed conflict that then spread and caused a significant amount of damage. Well, you look at that, you look at Notpetya, then you look at what the Russians are doing in the physical world. And then you look at what the Russians are doing, let's say the poisoning of Skripal in Salisbury, England, and all of these different things where they're doing these kind of lower level or activities that are just below the level of armed conflict. We don't look at it in total. We don't look at it as we're one action or one campaign that the Russians are waging against the West or waging against NATO or waging against the US. Instead, we say, well, was this individual action, did that rise to the level of armed conflict? No, then we can't do anything in self-defense militarily without violating international law. I contend that we need to start looking at the things that the Russians are doing in particular and aggregating them. And we say, well, clearly, the Russians, obviously, they violated international law when they entered and invaded Ukraine. That is a clear case of it. But what about Notpetya? What about Salisbury? What about SolarWinds? Each one of those individually is not an act of war. But when you combine them, does it rise to the level of an act of war? Does undermining our democracy in 2016 and subsequently, does that individually rise to a level of an act of war? No. But when you start looking at it in the context of what else have the Russians done over the past 5 years and the impact, the total impact of it, that very well may. And there is a term for this in international law called Nadelstichtaktik, meaning needle prick. And it's not successfully been used in international law, despite the Israelis have tried to raise this. But if we would actually take this needle prick theory of international law and apply it to cyberspace and apply it to the aggregate of nefarious or irresponsible activities, I think we would get to that point. And we could potentially then say to the Russians, this is how we are going to address your actions in the aggregate going forward. See what happens the next time you step out of line. And then if we do that, number one, we would then potentially be authorized to use military force in response in a time and tempo of our choosing. But number two, it may change their calculus because it's no longer now just one cyber attack. It's no longer just poisoning one defector. Now it's the aggregate of everything they're doing. And then the Russians aren't going to know what the red line is that would potentially result in a military strike against one of their military bases in response. So that's a very long answer to your question.
In the time that remains, Chris, I'd like to talk about one other aspect of what the Chinese and Russians are doing, which is to undermine our faith in our own institutions. Malware means that schools don't work or pipeline doesn't work or all sorts of things. That it has a cumulative effect of destroying our belief in our institutions. This is part and parcel at the heart of the Chinese and Russian strategy, as is the goal of deepening American political divides. We've done a very good job of that ourselves, but they are pouring gasoline onto the burning fire. One example that jumps out is from our reporting for the book was that a single Russian entity can create a website that says all teachers in schools should carry guns. And that website is in English and it's fluent enough that it penetrates our information ecosystem. At the same time, they create a website that says all guns should be banned everywhere in America. So then they have these two rival websites going up and they feed into the ecosystem. And they, if the American political argument on it cools, they can whip it up again. They can fire it up. So the Russians are particularly sophisticated doing this and they are doing it, not to mention outright interference in our elections. So it's not just about the technology here. It's a broader strategy than just that.
Yeah, you're absolutely spot on. That was another question I was going to ask. I know we're coming down to time, unfortunately, and we could talk about these topics for quite a while. They're playing a game that's, like you said, it's beyond just technology. They see the political divide. They see, the kind of factions within our society in terms of deeply held beliefs. And then they kind of stoke that tension so that, kind of undermine ourselves. We're so busy fighting among ourselves that we're not paying attention to those pinpricks that, Michael talked about that they're kind of conducting on an ongoing basis. One last question I wanted to ask you guys, because we are at time almost, and I want to be respectful of that, is, when we look at the book here in our society, you talked about anyone with an internet connection is essentially on the battlefield. We have this, vibrant society of freedom and autonomy, and, citizens here are using technology for everything, apps, tracking, their health, whatever kind of all these devices that are pervasive in our life and all the internet connections and software. How do we go about informing the citizenry? And then also, how do we go about balancing that dichotomy between freedom, for folks to do what they want, use whatever apps they want, share whatever data they want, but also understand the implications of what that means, for example, for national security?
Yeah. And so I think, Chris, there are a couple of things there to unpack. And first is people are going to make decisions that they want. And if you want, and there's a lot of technology out there that makes your life easier, right? There's a lot of, and I look at femtech, and I think the things that femtech has done for females as it relates to understanding their cycles, understanding what could potentially impact them, it's incredible. And there are things like women now have far greater insight into their own bodies than they ever did before as a result of technology. And that's fantastic. But where's that data going? And what happens if you now have that data that's being sold via ad tech or spying ink, so to speak? What happens when that data is now going to potential employers and that woman who didn't know she was pregnant is applying for a job and is disqualified from that job because the employer got the data from her femtech app saying, well, and we don't want to hire someone who's about to go on maternity leave, despite the fact that she doesn't even know it. Those types of things, and we could talk even about even more sensitive data like HIV or what have you, but those types of things, being able to openly share that information is important in certain contexts. The problem we have in this country is that we don't have an overarching federal data privacy regulation like the EU does. I'm not saying that one's perfect, but we don't have one at all. And so you have surveillance capitalism and you have all of these ad tech companies that are vacuuming up all of this data, combining it, and then selling it off to whoever wants to buy it. It becomes a huge issue across the board from a data privacy perspective. From a national security perspective, that data can also go to the Chinese. And so data that we are trying to restrict our own government from having, and we see this, the Fourth Amendment is not for sale act, which is currently going through Congress. We want to restrict the federal government from being able to access this information, but we have no problem with China getting all of the TikTok data because their laws say that the TikTok and ByteDance are required to turn that information over to them. And we're not restricting China from purchasing all of the ad tech data from these surveillance companies. And so the problem isn't necessarily that the data itself is we're oversharing. Yeah, that's a problem. The problem is that we don't have any sort of restrictions whatsoever on who collects that data and what they do with it.
So it's become a cliche by now. Christopher Wray of the FBI have said it. We need an all of nation or all of society response. We need to convince Americans that they have a role to play in managing the technology that's washed over us over the past 25 years, and doing so in a way that enables them to enjoy the fruits of that technology, but at the same time protects us from the downsides. And that means how we behave, how we log in. Do we click on that phishing email? Do we do multi-factor authentication? How do we organize our lives, our engagement with technology? So if we can persuade Americans that this is important in how they manage the technology in their daily lives, as we hope to do with this book, that would be the beginning stage of an effective response to what we're experiencing. That no one sector of our society, no one party in our government can do it alone. We need to come together to cooperate and figure out an American way of responding.
Yeah. So I just want to say personally, thank you guys both for coming on. This is a topic I'm incredibly passionate about. I've been digging into the book and really enjoying it. Again, I have the authors of Battlefield Cyber, How China and Russia Are Undermining Our Democracy and National Security. The book is out for pre-order on Amazon. I'll be dropping a link in the chat for folks that want to go check it out. It's an incredible book with a really critical topic that we all need to be paying much more attention to. I'll say we talked about a lot of aspects of our society. In terms of freedom, autonomy, you know, different agencies, institutions, you know, different ideas and thought. And I think that, you know, as much as it can be a weakness, I think those things can be a strength, too. As long as we remember who the ultimate enemy is and it's not ourselves within our own nation, we need to keep that in mind. So, folks, definitely check this book out. And Bill and Mike, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
Yeah, Chris, thanks for having us. This was great.